The Buddha's birthday, his day of his awakening, and day of his passing away. And symbolically, I think it's very nice that we celebrated all together the same day, meaning that the... Okay? Okay? So now the boring part. And you're either... So it's a celebration of... it's called the Vesak, which is... I think it basically kind of means the Pali word for the month of May, approximately. And it's approximately what we call the month of May. It's a lunar calendar they had in India. But it's approximately our month of May. It's usually the full moon. The full moon is a ways away, I think about a week or so away. But this is the closest day to the full moon that worked for our schedule to do it. And we usually do it the closest day to the full moon. It's considered the most sacred holiday in the Theravadan world. And people often come to the temple or the monastery and spend a day not only doing a certain amount of ritual, taking refuge like we did just now, but also living by the precepts, following the precepts very strictly, at least for that day. Even if people can't follow them strictly the rest of the time, they follow them strictly while at the monastery for that day. Yeah. I think all the kids need to either be down there or be outside now, because I need to be able to talk without being interrupted. So it's a celebration of the life of the Buddha. And in thinking about the life of the Buddha, you know, how do we remember the Buddha? How do we celebrate the existence of the Buddha? And many of you will have different relationships to the historical person of the Buddha. I'm thinking that there's two ways of understanding the story of the Buddha, very generally speaking. There's understanding the historical Buddha, who he was as a person, and story of his life from a historical point of view, what actually the facts of what his life was about. And then there's the myth. And the myth is a very broad word. I think in Greek, myth means story. It's a story we tell about the Buddha. And people tell lots of stories, and stories have a lot of functions for human beings. And human beings are probably considered homo story makers. That's kind of one of the key characteristics of human cultures. We tell each other stories, tell each other myths, and we live by those myths, and we live by their stories. They inspire us, move us in various ways. And there's a lot of myths that arose around the life of the Buddha, so much so that it's hard to distinguish between that which is historically true and what's the myths, the story-making that was created as a result of Buddhists being inspired and telling each other stories. And in fact, in India, most Buddhists had very little interest in this history, the historical aspects of Buddhism or the Buddha himself, in the way that we'd have in the modern West. And some of the modern studies on the life of the Buddha, which kind of try to piece together, kind of tease out of the records what might have been historically true, and kind of then paint a picture of the historical person, that kind of endeavoring, that kind of effort, was not something which people did in the ancient world. They weren't interested in that. And in a sense, we have maybe better sense of who the historical person was than maybe people for most of the 2,500 years of Buddhism because of the scholarly kind of tools of teasing that little details out. But it's very hard even to know which details can be teased out and what really is historical. One of the Tanisara Bhikkhu, a monk who comes here sometimes, responded once to a scholar who said, the Four Noble Truths, which are considered kind of the key core doctrines of Buddhism, couldn't have been taught by the Buddha. They were formulated after the Buddha. And he kind of just shrugged his shoulders and said he didn't really care about that, whether that was true or not, because he said whoever came up with the Four Noble Truths, that person's the Buddha for him. Whether it's a person historically called the Buddha or not doesn't really matter, because it's the Four Noble Truths which are such a fantastic tool for helping us in our lives. And if you go back and people tell stories about the Buddha, the stories get quite grandiose. They get bigger and bigger. It's like the fish that gets, you know, you caught. And with time, the fish gets bigger and bigger. Religious people tend to make their founders bigger and bigger figures down through the ages. And some of the amazing stories about who the Buddha was in the history of Buddhism. It puts some of the Western gods that we're familiar with, you know, to shame. You know, it's just Buddha becomes has tremendous powers and abilities, and it becomes godlike in probably every sense of the word, except for any sense of the way Buddhists want to admit it. But the Theravada tradition tends to take the Buddha to be a historical person and doesn't tend to deify him to great degrees, as they find some Mahayana traditions. But still, in some of the Theravada traditions, there's also this great myth about how amazing, you know, he's the most perfect person you ever walked the world, and has great powers and abilities, and how much of that. And so again, down through the centuries, these stories grow. The founders tend to grow, and some of us, you know, feel inspired by these stories, and some of us feel, you know, we don't want to get close to a religion that has these kind of great mythological stories that the tradition champions. If we go back and try to tease out a little bit of who the Buddha actually was, you know, from the historical records that survive, it doesn't really jive that well with some of the perfectionist images we have created in the story, the myths. You know, for example, most of the statues of the Buddha we see preserve the Buddha at this, you know, maybe the day of his enlightenment. You know, he's relatively young, he's healthy, he looks good, you know, he's maybe 36 years old, or sometimes he looks like he's 16, you know, radiant. But he, you know, he lived to be 80, 81 years old. And he talks about himself, you know, as being this, you know, all wrinkled and bent over in his old age. He wasn't this, you know, embody of, you know, he didn't talk about himself, at least in the records, of being this, you know, shining, you know, yogi who just kind of, you know, was perfectly fit. He had a bad back. And probably the later people who kind of wrote stories about the Buddha and kind of built up the myth, they probably didn't add that in, because usually you don't want your founder of your religion to have a bad back. It's not good press. So scholars think that probably that actually happened, and that was just preserved. But you know, the popular image, you know, of a statue is someone who's looks quite perfect, at least in different cultural ideas of what human perfection looks like. And was the Buddha a perfect person? How was he perfect? What kind of person was he? Many of us would like the Buddha to have been, you know, a phenomenally loving person. And he certainly taught a lot about the importance of love, of loving kindness. It seemed to be one of the pillars of what he wanted to teach. And probably he had a lot of loving kindness and compassion. And his 45 years of going around teaching in India was probably an expression of that. But when you look at the records that survive, the accounts of him meeting people and talking with people, he was very connected, very involved, but you don't get a sense of someone who was very affectionate in the way that maybe we want our religious leaders to have been affectionate, you know. There's no records of him giving anyone a hug. Rather, there's a record of him kind of always being a little bit kind of, you know, people always kept a distance from him. He was always a little bit, they always bowed to him, and he never bowed to anyone. The Buddha never bowed to anyone. That's kind of, there are no records of him doing that. There's no sign of kind of you know, sweet sentimental affection. There's a lot of records of is someone who had a great intellect and a great power of discernment, and used that power of intellect and discernment to help a lot of people to understand their lives better so that they become free. And you know, what was the presence? What was it like to be in the presence of the Buddha? And we use our imagination then to imagine what that was like. We don't have a lot of records of what that was like, except that people were really impressed by him. And on one hand, you have the teachings of the Buddha. On the other hand, you have the impression that he made on people. And maybe the two don't exactly make a perfect fit. Maybe they do, I don't know. But it's very interesting. The first one of the first records we have of him encountering people after his enlightenment were people who made a promise, made a commitment before he showed up to not offer him any respect. They knew him before he was a Buddha. They had been his companions for many years as doing ascetic practices. And the Buddha had stopped his ascetic practice and had taken some rich, luxurious foods. And they were really disgusted with Shakyamuni, with Siddhartha, for doing this. He'd left his ascetic life and taken the soft life. And they said, well, we're not going to offer him anything. We're not going to get up and stand when he comes. We're not going to offer him any respect. And, And he walked into their midst, and they felt so compelled to stand up and bow to him and offer him a seat and wash his feet and to listen to him. There was something about his presence that caught their, that really stopped them in their tracks in a sense, and compelled them to treat him in a very different way. And was it expression of, you know, boundless love? Was it an expression of great peace, of serenity, of great power, of strength? What was it that the Buddha was manifesting in his being, in his presence, that got people's attention? Who have you met in your life that have stopped you in your tracks? Because they seem to express a tremendous amount of love or joy or peace or feeling at home in the world in a way that was contagious and made you feel at home or felt peaceful. Rather than the Buddha being someone who expressed a lot of affection, I think of the Buddha as someone who experienced great peace. Rather than the Buddha being someone that we have to emulate and be like the Buddha, I think of the Buddha as being someone who discovered a capacity we all have for having, for not being in conflict with ourselves anymore or in conflict with the world, which can be another way of saying to be at peace. And I don't feel like I need to be inspired by the historical Buddha, that he has to be fit all my criteria of being the perfect human being, that it works for my model of perfection. Just like I don't care whether the person who discovered the vaccine for polio, you know, was a really nice guy. You know, I'm really happy that he discovered the vaccine. I'm really inspired by the idea of the Buddha discovering this fantastic path of peace. And when I think of the Buddha, when I celebrate the Buddha's birthday, his enlightenment day, the day of his passing away, I certainly want to offer my respect to the historical person who set it all in motion. And all of us are in this room today because of that person. Probably if it wasn't for the Buddha, we'd all be doing different things. We wouldn't be together as this particular community of people. So there's something about the power of what he set in motion, the power of his teaching, his experience of enlightenment, his presence, that was very compelling to a lot of people. And that compelling nature continues down through the ages. But what I find most inspiring is not who the Buddha was, but that what the Buddha represents. And this is where the story making comes into place, the myth making. It represents, maybe symbolically, a potential and possibility for each of us. And what is that? What's the symbolic meaning of that myth? What's the psychological meaning for ourselves? Is there some way that we can find our condition of our individual lives in the story of the Buddha in a way that helps our lives or shows a potential of how our lives can change for the better? So part of the myth of the Buddha is that he took these seven steps and then said, heaven above, earth below, I'm the greatest. Does that have any meaning for you personally? If it just has to do about the Buddha, you know, maybe it inspires you to offer more respect to him then, if he's the greatest. But is there some way you can see that myth, that story that the Buddhists tell each other, to be true for yourself? Is there some way that that's actually literally true for each of you, that you're the greatest? Now, logically, it doesn't make sense that we have the world filled with everyone thinking they're the greatest, because, you know, usually we think only one person can be the greatest. But is there some way that you can honor and respect yourself so deeply, where you feel that you yourself are so important that you can say that for yourself? And the suggestion in the Buddhist tradition is that you should find that place where you can say that. At the same time, that's not entangled with conceit and arrogance. Self-love is considered to be a very important quality in Buddhism. In the West, we're very confused about self-love because we think it might be narcissistic or arrogant. But it's a very important quality in Buddhism to cultivate a certain level of loving kindness towards oneself. And that becomes a basis for being able to do that to other beings also, to other people. So can we find that place of self-love, self-respect, where we can maybe say the same thing as the Buddha said in the myth? The story of the Buddha then continues, whether it's true or mythical, I don't know, but the story is that he was kept isolated from the suffering of the world around him as he was growing up. His father didn't want him to become a religious person, So he thought, well, if I just make him really comfortable and never show him any suffering, he won't be inspired to the spiritual life. He won't be inspired to find the truth. He won't be inspired to find the great potential within us to be awake and to be free. And so the Buddha then was lived in the suburbs, which is one of those places where you don't suffer. You don't see a lot of it. You know, you don't. I grew up in the suburbs of Los Angeles, and there was never there happened to be never an ambulance in our street that I can remember. There was never anyone who died that I knew on the street. It was kind of like a ghost town, actually, because everyone had their, you know, electric garage doors, and they would just drive into the garage, and then something happened behind the walls, but not in the street. And so, you know, we pretty up our life. We don't see suffering. The first dead person I saw was when I was 11, and I went to India and Nepal. And in Nepal, I saw four people carrying a stretcher where there was a corpse wrapped in white sheets being carried down to the river where they were going to burn the body at the cremation grounds. And that was the first time I saw a dead body. I'd grown up in the suburbs of Los Angeles where those things weren't kind of just public displays. So the Buddha grew up in the suburbs of Nepal and didn't see the kind of normal suffering that people see, that people in suburbs often don't see. I remember when we used to be in Palo Alto, how seldom I would go to East Palo Alto. And what a difference between the suffering of East Palo Alto and the suffering of Palo Alto. So the story is a story of someone who was isolated and protected from seeing the suffering of the world. Does that happen to us? Is that something that happens in our lives? To what degree do we protect ourselves from seeing the world as it actually is? And then, at some point, the Buddha jumped the wall of the palace, left the suburbs, went to East Palo Alto, or someplace like that, and lo and behold, he saw a sick person, which he'd never seen in the myth, an old person, which he'd never seen, and a dying person. And I imagine a sick, old, and dying person in ancient India was much more a dramatic scene than it is in the modern medical world of our society, where people get prettied up nicely. You know, you get old, and rather than having gray hair, you can get, you know, you get it dyed, or you get all these things get fixed. You know, you have false teeth. You know, so if you lose your teeth, you put false teeth in, and you look like you have real teeth. In ancient India, if you were old, they didn't have the kind of devices we have nowadays to make it look better. So when he saw an old person, probably had a big impact on him. And so imagine someone who's 29 years old, and this is the first time he has a full impact of seeing the suffering of the world. Symbolically, I think for some people, some adults, there's usually something that happens in adulthood that gets their attention, some suffering in the world. Sometimes it's their own suffering. Sometimes it's the death of their parents or death of their spouses or loved ones or some kind of great tragedy in the world, that, like September 11th, that really gets your attention, that wakes people up to the condition of this life we have, and people stop becoming complacent or start looking very seriously at what are the values and priorities by which I live my life. Some people live lives of dilettantes. And I think St. Francis, I think, is a story of someone who lived the life of a dilettante until something woke him up. And then he lived the life of a saint, whatever we think of that. Something catches our attention. And I think that most of us, most of you, who have come to meditation practice as adults, there was something that caught your attention. Some suffering, probably. It said, no one comes to Buddhism except through the door of suffering. And some people experience it much more powerfully. And the more powerful the suffering, the more powerful is the motivation, maybe to get to the bottom of this life, to understand it, to clarify it, to find the peace that's possible, to find a different way of living. It's been pointed out that some of the great religious figures of humankind, like the Buddha, I don't know them all, but I know in the Buddhist tradition, which I'm most familiar with, this is true for the Buddha and for Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, they lost their parents as children. The Buddha, his mother died when he was 7 days old. probably died giving birth to him. And Dogen, he lost his mother, I think, when he was 6 or 7. It's a huge psychological suffering involved with losing a parent. And so they were really, partly because of that suffering, they were phenomenally motivated to live a different way, to find a different way. If a person's suffering just a little bit of stress, then the motivations may be very different. So the Buddha was someone perhaps whose suffering was quite immense. And that's what really, or his encounter with suffering was really significant enough to propel him to do something very drastic. And what he did was he left his family to become a renunciant, a monk, and to kind of find out another way of living. Some people are horrified in the modern Western world, American world, to be a deadbeat dad. You know, it's considered a terrible thing, you know, to leave your family. And he left his wife with a young child. In the ancient Indian culture, he probably left after he had done, you know, the horrible thing he would have done in ancient Indian culture is left his wife and his family without giving birth to a son. That's the important, that's one of the great sufferings, not to have created the next generation. And so he took care of that responsibility. And you know, his wife was basically a queen and had a royal family, and so there's lots, it wasn't like she was going to become a welfare mom. But he took care of that responsibility. In that culture, that was what was needed to be done. And then he left and explored the religious life. And what he discovered was the possibility of being at peace, of no longer suffering. He found the causes of suffering in the human heart. And he pointed to the possibility of pulling out the barb of that suffering, the error of that suffering that resides in our hearts, so that our hearts can be free. The sure heart's release. How we live our life once the heart's been released depends on our personality. Some people are very loving in a very kind of beautiful ways. Some people are more great intellect. Some people are more, you know, with different ways and we express our personality. But the key thing is not our personality. The key thing is that in the heart of our personality, there's peace. The Buddha, in the night of his enlightenment, which is one of the things we celebrate on the Buddha's on today, also can be seen symbolically. You can just look at how does your life relate to the story of the Buddha's enlightenment? The story of the enlightenment is someone who sat down to meditate, and he'd meditated before. He'd learned lots of meditations before. There were techniques. And he gave all those up for what can be understood as a techniqueless practice, where he sat down with a childlike openness, because what he remembered was what he was like when he was 6 years old, and he sat under a rose apple tree at the edge of a field, in a situation where he was left alone in a nice, comfortable, warm day, and he sat there, probably cross-legged, as maybe children can do, and attained, settled into himself, settled into a kind of concentrated, peaceful state that was very happy, that didn't require any doing or any making, any technique, just kind of his natural state, just relaxed, and he settled into this happy state, as sometimes children often experience. And then as a 35-year-old adult, he remembered that experience as a 6-year-old. He thought, I've tried every other path that Indian religions have to offer, and none of them worked for me. Why don't I try this one? Why don't I try the path of a 6-year-old? So it's not like this great, difficult thing to do. A 6-year-old can do it. And it's a practice of not having a technique at all, but rather sitting down with childlike openness to whatever arises, not resisting or judging or pushing anything away or making anything happen, completely open to life as it is. The other half of that story is that he sat there with adult-like stability. And it's that combination of a kind of childlike openness with a tremendous adult-like strength, which what carried him over into his night of his enlightenment, to his enlightenment. Because what happens when you open up to that kind of childlike openness, to allow everything to bubble up, is that all the psychic forces, all the demons that we've been repressing or denying or hiding from, sometimes have a chance to just explode. And in the myth of the Buddha, they exploded in the form of Mara. And Mara came with tremendous force the night of his enlightenment. And the Buddha hung in there, had this adult-like stability that allowed him to keep open, the childlike openness. Then the story continues that Mara used his last weapon. And his last weapon was doubt. And he asked the Buddha, "What right do you have to become awakened?" And what's significant here is that certainly maybe the doubt is maybe one of the last hindrances each of us has to face before we realize the possibility of being at peace, of radical, unconditional trust in life. But what's significant here, I think, is that what the Buddha did in response. Until then, when Mara hurled all his forces onto the Buddha just sat there with his adult-like stability. When the last weapon of Mara came hurling at the Buddha, that of doubt, the Buddha didn't stand there anymore, sit there firmly, but the Buddha reached down and touched his hand to the ground and called upon the goddess of the earth to bear witness to his right to become awakened. And to me, that's psychologically tremendously significant, because at some point in the path to becoming deeply at peace, to resolving all our deep conflicts in our heart, we can maybe no longer rely on just our own powers and strengths and our own abilities. We have to somehow turn to something that's larger than us, greater than us, maybe nature itself, the goddess of the earth. And he called upon nature to bear witness to his right to be awakened. And that was what he needed then to withstand the forces of Mara, the last weapon. And then he became awakened, became someone then who became free. Then today we also celebrate the Buddha's passing away, his death. And symbolically, I think it's quite beautiful, his death. As far as I know, none of you remember having died before. Some of you have been pretty close, but I don't know how much you remember. And but the idea that we're all going to die sooner or later becomes important for us. Some people hold it off as much as they can. I know one man who's 72 years old, who refuses to talk about his dying. Just, he even gets anywhere close to it, he shuts off and walks away. Sooner or later, we have to face this death and decide what we're going to do about it. I think, I've said this a lot, but I think a lot of the, I used to think that people got wise as they got older because they had a lot of life experience. But now that I'm getting older, I think that's some of it. But I think part of the wisdom of the elders in our society is because they feel the proximity of their death. And that feeling your life next to death, in the relationship to death, changes a person's priorities and changes the way we see and understand our human life. And it can breed a lot of wisdom or a lot of suffering, like the 72-year-old that I know who shuts off. So sooner or later, we have to kind of relate to this death. The Buddha, in the story, the myth of the Buddha, he died peacefully. And I find it very inspiring to have this model of someone who found some way of living a life so that in the living of the life, he could also die with great serenity and peace. And the story is that he was about 80, 81 years old, and he was quite sick in the last days of his life. And he talked about how painful his body was. And sometimes the only way he got some relief from the pain of his body was to go into very deep states of meditation, where he kind of removed himself from the physical body and attained some rest there. And he made his way, he kept walking. He was going somewhere. No one knows why he kept walking, but he kept walking until he came to a place that was kind of near a little village, kind of out in the woods a little bit. And he laid himself down between two sala trees, between two trees. And he let the number of people come and visit him, and he gave some last teachings. And then that night of the full moon in May, he laid himself down, it said, on his right side, with his head, with hand holding his head, and entered into meditative states, and went one last round, toured all the meditation states that he knew, a tour of them, and then entered into the meditative state of greatest equanimity, a place of tremendous peace and equanimity. And from there, he passed on or passed away, or he gave up his life that we understand human life to be like. And the model of someone who with great control, great peace, great ease, trust, is able to just lay themselves down to die, have control over how that dying process happens, choose the state of the mind that he or she's going to be in at the moment of death, and probably chose to let go, that final letting go, that's the letting go of dying, chose that moment, have that ability, I find tremendously inspiring. And I don't know if it's true or it's a myth the Buddhists tell each other, but I find it for myself psychologically very inspiring that that's something maybe I can try to find, how to resolve all of my conflicts and my fears so that maybe I could find a way to lay down myself to die when it's my time to die, if I'm blessed enough to die slowly, to die in such a way that I feel at ease without any conflict, without any regrets, without any fears, and just lay down and let the natural process unfold as it does while I'm at peace. So for me, I feel tremendous gratitude to the Buddha. I'm not sure whether that gratitude goes towards the symbolic Buddha, the mythic Buddha, or the real Buddha, but for me, it doesn't matter so much because it points to a potential and possibility that we all have. And each of us has to somehow relate to the potential we have in our own hearts to change ourselves, to transform ourselves, or to align ourselves to live a life that has no conflict, where we feel at peace and at ease at each moment, each step we take in life. We feel at ease and at peace without any internal conflicts about who we are and what we're doing. And the figure of the Buddha represents that possibility. So how do you decide? How do you relate to that potential that you have? So those are my thoughts, and I hope that they were appropriate enough. What I'd like to do now, it's a little bit late, but hopefully you'll indulge, is what I'd like to do is for us to take the precepts. We took the refuge before, and then to recite the five lay precepts, and then we'll end. And then if you'd like to come up as we leave, you can come up and wash the baby Buddha. And you can understand that washing any way you like, but one way you can understand that is when you wash the baby Buddha, you're really washing yourself. And what are you washing away when you wash yourself? So the precepts. I'll chant half of each line, and then you can repeat after me. For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to kill. For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to take what is not given. For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to lie. For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to misuse my sexuality. For the sake of our practice together, I vow not to intoxicate my mind with drugs or alcohol. And may the precepts, be a great support and help for you to understand how to have a heart that's free of all conflict. May all of you be happy, may all of you be peaceful, and may all of you be awake. May the Buddha in your hearts flower into your life. Thank you.